From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. We're starting this week's show on a boat near the top of the world. Reporter Amy Martin of the podcast Threshold is about to visit a part of the United States that's been fought over for decades, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, or ANWR.
Ready to go?
Right, you want to come inside?
The captain of the boat is Vebjorn Aishana Reitan. Vebjorn's in his early 20s and lives in the village of Koktovik. If you look at a map of Alaska, it's way up in the northeast on a small barrier island. Vebjorn's taking Amy and her colleague Nick Mott over to the mainland. It's a cloudy day, and as they motor along, the edge of the North American continent slowly emerges from the mist.
What you see is a great ocean. A line of green and black, that is the land. And above that, big gray, and that's the sky.
The refuge is almost 10 times the size of Yellowstone National Park, but with no roads, no hotels, no souvenir shops, just wilderness. It's the largest wildlife refuge in the country, home to wolves, Arctic foxes, wolverines, Canada lynx, and all three types of North American bears. And this northern part of it is known as the Coastal Plain. It's where tens of thousands of caribou nurture their newborn calves. It's also where oil companies have been fighting for the right to drill for more than 40 years, a fight they won in 2017 when they got congressional approval, even though most Americans are still opposed to it. For Vebjorn, this place of controversy is just his home.
I don't think people think of it as a refuge even. We just think of it as our... it's where we come from, kind of.
Vebjorn's dad is from Norway. His mom is from Koktovik, which is actually inside the refuge. She's from the Inupiaq indigenous group.
I've been on the refuge since before I could walk. My mom would carry me in the back of her parka.
So it's just been part of your whole life?
Yeah. Refuge is important to us.
We're spending this hour in the refuge with our partners from the podcast Threshold, who won a prestigious Peabody Award for their reporting. We originally ran this show in March. Since then, a major development has happened. About 2 weeks ago, the Trump administration finalized plans to open up part of the refuge to oil and gas development. Amy Martin, whose reporting was supported by the Pulitzer Center, takes it from here.
As we move toward the coast, the palette is simple, just like Vebjorn said. It's all grays, muted greens, and soft browns. Wow, it's beautiful out here. We approach the coastal plain, and Vebjorn tells us to hop out while he secures the boat. I'm more than happy to comply.
Yes!
I'm feeling a little giddy because I'm finally standing in this place that I've been hearing about for my entire adult life. We're on a little spit of land, gravelly beach, and a little blustery, windy, dewy, wet, and in front of us is the green tundra of the coastal plain. It's gorgeous. My first impression is just wide open space. The Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is huge, almost 20 million acres, or about 30,000 square miles. So if we were to hike from this spot on the coastal plain down to the southern boundary of the refuge, it would be like walking across the state of South Carolina or the entire country of Austria without seeing a single town or house or road. You can picture the refuge as having three main regions: brushy foothills in the south, the mighty Brooks Range cutting across the middle, and then in the north, where we are, this swath of tundra resting between the mountains and the ocean. And all of these habitats, high alpine, riparian, coastal plain, they all flow together with nothing human-made to intrude or interrupt. This variety and connectivity is part of what makes the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge unique and highly attractive to so many different species of animals. This is wild country. It's just this beautiful, huge, wide open plain. I lie down in the grass to listen and look. It's like an ocean of grass. And there's a sense of solitude. I wanted to talk to the people who have the most at stake if drilling happens here. So Nick and I go to Kaktovik, Vebjorn's home. It's a village of about 300 people, and it's the only town inside the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Now that Congress has approved drilling, people could have rigs operating right next door to them. But it could also mean that this town is suddenly awash in cash. And I wanted to know how people here are feeling about that.
I know there's another bear in town. I'm sure I saw one.
Robert Thompson runs a company that takes people on tours to see polar bears in and around Kaktovik. He'd spotted some bears close to his house on the other side of the village and drove over to get us so we could see them too. He drives us slowly along the gravel roads, scanning for bears, and then parks on the edge of town, facing out toward the ocean. He thinks we have a good chance of seeing a bear here.
It's a cold, gray, drizzly morning. Oh, there it is.
Yep, there is a bear.
Where are you seeing it?
Over there.
Straight ahead.
Oh, yeah. Hey, buddy.
I'll turn sideways.
There's another one by the fence.
It is, yep.
Two bears are ambling along the edge of the island, clearly led by their noses. They lower their heads to sniff the ground and then raise them to sniff the air in a sort of slow rhythm as they walk. Robert says as the Arctic warms, more and more bears are coming to the refuge and to Kaktovik.
You know, and in a time when all the ice is gone in the Arctic Ocean, all the bears are going to have to come ashore. So they could become extinct.
Polar bears evolved to spend a lot of time living on sea ice. They sleep on it, they hunt seals and other ocean animals from it, they even build their winter dens in it. But lately, sea ice has been receding into the far north in the summers, and it can carry the bears into really deep water, where they have a hard time finding food. Robert thinks some polar bears are learning to get off the ice before it melts, and instead make a go of it on land, places like the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and barrier islands like this one. This influx of polar bears has been good for Robert's guiding business, but it's also made him keenly aware of what's at stake here.
I could be here and see the last polar bear in Alaska. That would be sad to see. Oh, I haven't seen a bear for a few years. Oh, they must be gone. Could be. You know, people don't realize that this climate change is quite serious. Is he still walking?
Yeah, it's actually... Oh, yeah. It looks like it's almost... The water's, like, getting deeper, and it's maybe about to start swimming. I don't know. You can see a little black nose moving back and forth.
This is kind of how it went with Robert. We're taking in this really heavy information about the long-term prospects for these animals while simultaneously getting our minds blown, watching them go about their polar bear business. It's just a few degrees above freezing, the wind is whipping and tossing up big waves, and the polar bear we're watching just strolls into the water as if it's strolling across a park.
It's just kind of bobbing around out there in the ocean. It's crazy.
One of the surreal things about this scene is that when I glance behind me, I can see the village of Kaktovik right there. Kaktovik has actually set up a community polar bear patrolling system to alert residents when bears get close and to try to haze them away from the village. Robert says all of this is a big change from how it used to be. He grew up in interior Alaska, but he moved to Kaktovik more than 30 years ago.
But bears weren't really a problem until recently with climate change and the Arctic Ocean is opening up. When I first came, you could see the pack ice from the shore all summer.
How far away would that be?
Oh, within sight, like 4 or 5 miles. There was ice there all the time. We'd go out there with a boat and sit on the ice and hunt seals or whales. But now, last time I went whaling, we didn't see any ice. We won't see any now. It's all gone. There's probably 200 miles of open water right now. And every year it's more.
And this is one of the main reasons why Robert is strongly opposed to oil development in the refuge. He sees a direct relationship between drilling for oil and losing polar bears. He says he asks his neighbors who support oil development,
what do you want to do? Make a lot of money or preserve the culture? They know that it's not right to be that way.
What would you say to people who are like, you know what though? The people in Kaktovik, they live here. They need the money to help their community. And, you know, there's the argument like, well, we need the money.
Well, they can go get a job and work for it. I don't have much sympathy with that because I'm not worried about money. And they don't need this money to get ahead in this community because they still got, 95% of the North Slope that could be exploited. They don't need to do the refuge to get the money.
He doubts that the people of Kaktovik will really benefit that much from drilling. He thinks they're being sold an empty dream.
And I've seen in writing criticism, he does trips and he's making money off it. Well, yes, I am. I'm showing people the refuge. And then they go and talk about it. So there's some resentment that there's people here showing the public about it. So I'm not going to worry about it. It can't trip me up. I fought for the right of freedom of speech, democracy. And I can say anything I want.
And when Robert says he fought for that right, he means it very literally. He's a veteran of the Vietnam War.
My 20th birthday was my first day of duty in Vietnam. And they put me on duty. I said, it's my 20th birthday, first day of duty in Vietnam. And then I came up here and started living here and hunting. And I said, hey, they're going to put an oil field where I go hunting. And I don't want to live in an oil field. So I do what I can to stop that.
Do you think your experience in Vietnam shapes how you look at some of these environmental issues at all?
To some degree, because, you know, the peace and tranquility you get from being on the land is something that we should all look at, you know, especially after, being in a war and so on.
You could feel how you needed that.
Oh, yeah. A lot of people do.
One of the questions that comes up again and again in the national debate over the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is, if you've never been to the refuge, if you don't live in Alaska, should you have a say in determining the fate of this place? Robert Thompson says yes. He says you don't have to live in Kaktovik to find meaning and comfort in knowing the refuge is there, without the roads and lights and noise that fill up so much of the rest of this planet.
Most people won't be out on that refuge. 325 million people in the United States. What percentage will ever get here? But to know that there's places still, I guess you'd say for future generations that are pristine and nice to go to. So those are things that people should look at.
That's not how Matthew Rexford sees it. I went on a tour of this same village with him, and he says this community needs oil development in order to thrive. Matthew's 34 years old. He's lived in this village his whole life, and like most people in Kaktovik, he's Inupiat. He's the tribal administrator here, among several other leadership roles.
This runway was installed around the Cold War era, 1940s, 1950s, and 60s. And the original Kaktovik community settlement was where this old runway used to be in front of us.
We're driving on a low-lying, narrow strip of land. Matthew says when the Air Force wanted a place to land their planes, they bulldozed the village that was here, and the local people had to rebuild in a new spot on the island. And that was just the first time.
In the 1950s, there was a second relocation of the community, and in the 1960s, there was the final relocation of the community to where Kaktovik is right now.
So the community's been moved three times?
Three times.
Many of the houses are built up on piers that lift them above the puddles and pools seeping up from the permafrost soil. And almost every home is surrounded by the signature gear of Arctic life. Four-wheelers and boats, sleds and snowmobiles, plus the occasional muskox hide, whalebone, or set of caribou antlers.
How have you seen the village change in your 34 years?
Oh, so prior to, I'd say around the year 2000, our community didn't have a water sewage system installed as it is today, where we can flush a toilet. Prior to that, we had honey buckets, and a lot of this infrastructure in our community, the gravel roads, the power and electricity, the water infrastructure, have been built from the tax revenues for the oil and gas infrastructure development in the pipeline.
So when you get to flush a toilet in Kaktovik, you can thank the oil industry.
Oh, yes, yes.
Although most of the land of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is owned by the federal government, more than 90,000 acres of the coastal plain is native land. But because that native land is part of the refuge, oil development has been prohibited there.
Our lands have always been locked up, and no development has ever occurred on our lands in regards to oil and gas development.
So when you say it's been locked up, like you're saying that for your whole life, nobody has been able to make any money from oil and gas development on native lands.
Yes, on the coastal plain, that is correct. It took an act of Congress to allow for the coastal plain to be opened up.
And then that happened in December 2017 with the passage of the tax bill. How did that feel to you when you got the news like it passed?
It felt like a blessing. I mean, the opportunities for our people have been opened up, and if any development does occur in and around our area, we want to ensure that it is done right.
It's important to keep in mind that Alaska Natives never consented to have any of their lands owned by the United States or anyone else. And the people of Kaktovik don't fully control the small portion of their historic lands that they do own now. There are indigenous people with strong feelings on both sides of this debate, but native voices are often left out of the conversation. Matthew's uncle, Fenton Rexford, traveled to Washington, D.C. in March of 2019 to testify in support of drilling. At the time, House Democrats had introduced a bill aimed at stopping it.
We are not an exhibit in a museum, nor should the land that we have survived and thrived for centuries be locked away for the peace of mind from those from faraway places.
Fenton tells lawmakers about the history of his community.
1947, the U.S. military, Cold War, arrived on Border Island and Kaktovik to build a 5,000-foot runway and hangar. We were told to move our village, our homes, our ice cellars, graves and cemeteries were bulldozed and filled in.
He lists a series of injustices, including the creation of the Arctic National Wildlife Range in 1960, the predecessor to the current refuge.
The range was established without our input, Kaktovik input, without consultation. Our rights to hunt were now restricted further. 1964, the military directed again the third time to move.
And then in 1980 came the bill that doubled the size of the wildlife range and added it to the National Wildlife Refuge System. This looked like a huge conservation win to many people in the lower 48. But Fenton says it felt very different in Kaktovik.
The interest of the outside conservation groups have trumped the interest of our people. We have spent over 40 years lobbying Congress to allow oil and gas leasing within the coastal plain, even leasing on our own native lands. Requires the act of Congress. Since the federal government showed up 152 years ago, the outside groups have used the federal government as a tool to assert their own interest in our land. This school of thoughts amounts to nothing more than green colonialism, a political occupation of our land in the name of environment.
For the general public, the fight over drilling in the refuge is about the value of wildlife and pristine places versus the value of oil. But for many people in Kaktovik, the heart of this conflict is about something else entirely, sovereignty, and all of the ways it's been ignored. For some people in this community, oil development feels like a way to fight back against colonization and put more power in the hands of local people. For others, it feels exactly the opposite, that drilling is just the next step in the colonization process and that it will only further erode their culture. But even if they disagree on oil development, everyone I met in Kaktovik expressed a strong common value, a determination for Inupiaq culture to survive.
But the Inupiaq people aren't the only Alaska Natives who live here and are fighting to keep their culture alive. We go 150 miles south to find what oil development means in Arctic Village. That's next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.